sing this.
The opinions expressed on this program are those of my guests and do not reflect the opinions of KHAN or its board of directors. Are streamed on the internet at khen.org. And if you would like to listen to tonight's program or any past programs of Truth Quest with Melody, they're available at www.gimmesometruth.info or linked from the khen.org website. And if you would like to send an email into the program for questions with our guest, our email address is khen.dj@gmail.com.
You know, the essence of the message there, and sometimes they're pretty good.
Gentlemen,
go ahead.
We're joining the program now, and I wanted to say we've got Truth Quest with Melody, and because it kind of got a little bit cut off at the beginning of the intro. But tonight I've got two very special guests, and one of them is returning. This is Chris Emery, and he... Currently, you don't have a radio program now, do you, Chris?
No, I stepped away back in May of this year, and my co-host took the show. I'm very honored to have them carry on with it. It was formerly Radio Free Oklahoma, and now it's called Free Mind Radio on the Rule of Law Radio Network. And if you just Google freemindradio.com, it's a Wednesday night broadcast from 8 to 10 p.m. Central Time on Wednesdays.
And this ties in with your film company then, correct?
It's separate. It's a separate network. It just so happened that they're Free Mind Films. It's a similar name, but it's a separate film company altogether.
Okay.
Just Free Mind Radio was just the name of the show itself.
Okay. Well, I was just shooting in the dark there, I guess.
Sure. No, that's all right. I appreciate you asking. Thank you for the recognition.
And then also our other guest this evening is Harmon Taylor. And Harmon, would you like to tell us a little bit about yourself? And by the way, with Chris Emery, you know, like, again, he's back, but he's been heavily working on the Oklahoma City bombing, and Harmon ties right in with this.
Yeah, Chris and I met at the time that the
Terre Haute litigation was going on, and he would suffered through all of that with us. My background, of course, I'm in Dallas, coming live from Dallas this evening. Background in physics and electrical engineering before law school, and went into solo practice, mostly tax matters and commercial litigation matters. Had a year where I was both in Dallas and in Denver, and then a year after that was in Houston for 3 years, and after that changed careers back to programming, which is what I'd done during college. And then we got the tail end of the Murrah Building bombing and related litigation, and there were way too many questions about that came up for me to say, yeah, I need to stay programming and not go back to law. So the Terre Haute litigation matter is what got me back into doing active legal work. And that case, in summary, was the effort to preserve evidence from the Murrah Building bombing matters. And the effort they are focused on, how do you preserve evidence? Well, you stop the execution. So the fundamental point of the litigation was to preserve evidence. The mechanism was to stop the execution. There was a 30-day stay, an administrative stay granted. The cover story for that stay was the disclosure and release to the defense parties, another 3,000-some-odd pages of documents that had not been turned over before. At least that was the story. And so during that time period, the Terre Haute litigation went on in Terre Haute, Indiana, while all the news coverage was still in Denver. And so trial court, of course, dismissed us out. The appellate court affirmed that dismissal, and it's the appellate court opinion that changed everything fundamentally about my understanding of this system. I had a constitutionist perspective, of course, my whole life. We all do. That's what we're taught. And Terre Haute litigation changed that for me. I've been cured of my red, white, and blue fever, as Pat Shannon likes to label it. The people that say, oh, that stuff can't happen in America, this is America, that can't happen. Well, it's happening. And those that say it can't happen, the attribution from one of our key investigative journalists in the matter, Pat Shannon, labels that as red, white, and blue fever. So to apply his more modern concept, I was cured of my red, white, and blue fever through the Terre Haute litigation.
Okay, now, would you like to explain a little bit of what Terre Haute litigation was? I mean, and what it had to do with this event?
Yes, of course, McVeigh was housed in the federal death facility there in Terre Haute, Indiana, or I guess just outside of Terre Haute, Indiana. And so the point for filing a lawsuit there is because that's where his custodian was, namely the fellow in charge of that prison facility. The arguments made there basically challenged the subject matter jurisdiction of the federal court in Colorado. We can read Article 3, Section 2, Article 4, Section 2, and the Sixth Amendment and get a real basic concept that if it's a criminal case, it can't be tried outside the state in which it occurred. It's something that is so common sense to us at this stage that we just don't even think about what happens when a criminal case is exported. And if it's a criminal case, then it occurred in Oklahoma. Okay. State court or federal court, it's a homicide case, which means it should never have been in the federal court in the first place. Instrumentality is irrelevant in the normal homicide thinking. The system has changed that a little bit to say if you use an airplane or a bomb, that's a homicide within the federal jurisdiction, which is just telltale signs of the whole thing about where this case takes us. But it's a homicide case. It should have been in the state court. And it's not only not in the state court, but it's not in Oklahoma.
Now, was Chris at this Terre Haute, is that what you're saying, that where you two met?
No, actually, I met Harmon through a mutual friend that was living in Fort Worth, Jerry Longspaw, who actually, my interest in the case was through a video of unedited raw footage that was shot that morning by some of the stranger cameramen from the local radio or TV stations in Oklahoma City. They got down to the crime scene in about 20 minutes. Through Jerry knew of Harmon's excellent work with the litigation. And I believe the first event that you and I attended, Harmon, was in October of 2001, when the threat of bio-threat terrorism came on the heels of the September 11th event. And we attended a conference in downtown Fort Worth, I believe at the medical college down there. And just so happened one of the lead case agents for the FBI, Danny Deffenbaugh, was one of the speakers. And I knew that the case in Oklahoma City was unraveling almost from day one, and Deffenbaugh was instrumental in making sure that the subterfuge and a lot of the interference by the federal authorities came to be on that case. So Harmon, I think it was a few weeks after that, Harmon invited me over to his house. We went through page by page.
Was it after that or before that? It may have been after that. I was thinking it was a few months before. But
yeah,
at any rate, you were over here, and we went through a bunch of stuff.
It was amazing. It was just a complete eye-opening. And I walked out of your house, Harmon. I'll never forget this. And I was in shock. I was literally in a daze because what that litigation proved, Melody, and Harmon obviously can back this up, is that he's right. Our Constitution means absolutely nothing. The federal government, part and parcel separate from what we think of as the U.S. constitutional government, pretty much had their way with that case and with Harmon's litigation and drummed him out of court, with resolute, complete arrogance. And the defendant had absolutely no, the plaintiffs had no chance whatsoever on that case. It was rigged from the word go, and it was shocking. Anything that you learn about history from kindergarten through high school, throw it out the window and start all over again. And that was my epiphany right there. And I never looked back. I said, that's why we're going to make this film, not only because of that case, but because of everything else that happened in Oklahoma City. And people need to sit up straight and pay attention and realize what's going on here, because it's only going to get worse.
Okay, now, in the film is what that you're making?
The film is a feature-length film on the Oklahoma City bombing. The working title is called An Oval Eye, which is out of a quote from Plato and some of his work, which means that the rulers of the society pander a lie to us to make sure that there's law and order, even though it flies in the face of reason and common sense and evidence to show otherwise that... In this case, what we've been told about the Oklahoma City case simply is not true. We're very honored to state right now that Harmon is an interview in that film, among several others, and we're very excited to have him be part of the project. And he has been directly and indirectly for several years, so it's definitely an honor to have him on board.
So the Terre Haute was a deciding point for you, Harmon, in that...
The proof of the in-your-face attitude by the people that can wholesale butcher innocent non-combatants, literally to make a political point. What is the definition that the feds use for terrorism? There's four or five different definitions, and it depends on the use of it as to how specific it is. Obviously, the CIA's definition is extremely broad. That comes within a lot of administrative activities. The legal definition is pretty narrow, and a terrorist in the legal definition is someone who uses violence or threats of violence to make a political point. Okay, when we get to the understanding of why the Murrah Building and why then, we get to the understanding of terrorism. And in that building were documents of investigation of drug trafficking by very high-ranking officials in originally the state government and then the federal government. And so the drug dealers that were being targeted in that investigation are the people who set it all up and who made the building explode, so as to destroy those documents. So that was a very in-the-face act as far as that goes. my angle comes in on the legal side, and it's an extremely in-our-face kick, steel-toed tip boots to the face. This is what your Constitution does to those of us in charge. And the answer is it does nothing. Your Constitution is worthless. Watch us tread it underfoot. And so it was the awareness of the complete irrelevance of those concepts that changed my perspective on the legal system.
If I may interject here real quick, Melody, if people, the best way to understand this case is to break it down in the simplest of terms. Harmon's case was the pinnacle of the absolute, resolute arrogance and audacity of how the federal government not only lacked a proper investigation, but how they tried the case. And then Harmon's step was to actually go back and file an appeal and a stay of litigation, a stay of execution for McVeigh, just to have him as both a human and physical evidence to show that this case simply could not have occurred the way it was stated. Well, the federal government was bound and determined to make sure that didn't happen, and that's why they ruled against Harmon. And the two plaintiffs, Jane Graham and V.Z. Lawton, who were actually survivors of the bombing, they were in the building that morning. And both of them were material witnesses to the fact that there were several explosions in the building by virtue of the fact that it was coming down a full 5 to 8 seconds before the truck bomb even blew up. In the whole scheme of things, and Harmon knows this, he's seen our storyboards and our sequence of how we're putting the film together, and the whole sequence of events that morning, the truck bomb was simply an afterthought because that building was coming down from east to west in controlled demolition for 5 to 8 seconds before the Ryder truck even blew up. Now, what I have here in front of me is a conclusion paragraph. If you don't mind, I'll read this, and this will tie in, dovetail perfectly with what Harmon is saying. Because when you first of all, you have the event happen. 4 hours later, you have 14 Learjets flying from Andrews Air Force Base outside of Washington with the top dogs from all of the agencies and three agencies we never knew even existed. These guys are coming in with their big shoulders and ordering around the Oklahoma City Fire Department, the Oklahoma City Police, the Oklahoma County Sheriff's Department, and the Oklahoma Highway Patrol, and telling them what to do on a crime scene in downtown Oklahoma City. Just sheer arrogance. Had no business. They had no jurisdiction there. And that's a whole other story in and of itself, as far as the deed on the building, who actually owned it, and so forth. It was never owned by the federal government. Okay, so we go ahead and leapfrog ahead to the actual investigation and how the FBI failed to have anything credible as far as the chain of custody on the evidence gathered from that crime scene that day. It's horrendous. If you were to take a course in how not to investigate a case, this would be a textbook example from A to Z, how to screw it up from the word go. And it was deliberate. It wasn't by accident. It wasn't just incompetence. It was by design. Then we go ahead to Dr. Frederick Whitehurst, who was one of the top forensic lab experts in the FBI lab in Washington, D.C. He was specifically asked not to come to Oklahoma City because they knew his top officers, his supervisors knew he wouldn't lie for anyone on there. This guy shot straight from the word go, and he would have told it like it is, which would have completely torpedoed the prosecution's case. He wouldn't have had a leg to stand on. So what I'm looking at here is a report that was done by the Inspector General's office in Washington, D.C. after the fact. We're going ahead and leapfrogging ahead to 1997. This report was withheld by the order. It was put under seal by Judge Richard Mace, who presided over both the Nichols federal trial and the McVeigh federal trial. The prosecution couldn't see it. The defense counsel couldn't see it. None of the jury members in both trials could not see it. This would have single-handedly rendered anything the prosecution had as complete garbage. They were literally standing on sand, and this would have been the tidal wave that washed it away. Would you mind if I just take less than a minute here to read one key paragraph in the conclusion?
Go ahead.
Okay. Now, David Williams was actually one of the lead FBI lab experts that was asked to testify on the stand. This guy committed perjury so many times, it was disgusting. He took the place by request of the FBI in place of Dr. Whitehurst. Now, Williams, this is coming from the Inspector General, referring to David Williams. He called him Super Dave. This guy was incompetent as a day long. And anyway, it says, Williams' report, and how his report and everything they found, chain of custody and so forth. Williams' report contains several serious flaws. His opinion as to the VOD, which is velocity over distance, of the main charge was unjustifiable. His statement of the velocity over distance of ANFO was incomplete. His categorical identification of the main charge as ANFO was inappropriate. His estimate of the weight of the main charge was too specific and based in part on improper grounds. His conclusion as to the containers for the main charge was unjustifiably categorical. His categorical identification of the initiator for the booster was improper. His conclusions concerning non-electric detonator, the fuse, and the time delay were scientifically insupportable. His conclusions were not supported by the contents of any other report, and he included some AE dictation in his selective or confusing way. These errors were all tilted, get this, in such a way to incriminate the defendants. We are troubled, meaning we, the Inspector General and his staff, we are troubled that the opinions in the Williams report may have been tailored to conform to the evidence associated with the defendants. We conclude that Williams failed to present an objective, unbiased, and competent report. You have these words jumping out of this one paragraph conclusion out of a 33-page report. This was a scathing report, literally shredded any credibility of the prosecution's case. And that's why the judge would not let the prosecution, the defense, nor any of the jury members see this. Can you imagine if this was presented? McVeigh may have not been, number one, been sentenced to death. And I know for sure, darn well, that Nichols would have been out of prison by now. You have unjustifiable, too specific, improper grounds, unjustifiably categorical, improper. I mean, what other conclusion can you render from this report other than it was complete incompetence, it was by design that this was a criminal investigation, and Harmon tried to go ahead and have actually offer these guys to save face for them. And they just stomped right on his face and said, not only no, but hell no, get out of our court, and this is where we're going to chase you off. It's unbelievable. And people wonder why we're still investigating this case.
Now, how many people are still in jail over this?
Besides Nichols?
Nichols. So,
I don't know if we've got anyone associated, other witnesses or anybody still in jail or not.
We had Michael Fortier. He turned state's evidence, rolled on. Yeah, and of course he made up one whopper after another. You talk about perjuring yourself on the stand. He got out 3 years ago, served 8 years of a 10-year prison sentence, got out 2 years for good behavior, and he's on the witness protection program now. He's a marked man. There's a lot of people that are ticked off at him.
Okay, so in making this film, and whether it gets wide distribution, which I hope it does, what do you expect to gain by this?
We would like to see indictments handed down. I mean, the bottom line is, Melody, number one, and Harmon can vouch for this, we do not, absolutely do not, want to remember the death of these people and alive. That's not even an option anymore. We're going to correct the official record of what's happening here. Because we want people to, two or three generations from now, to realize that they've been given the complete snow job on this thing. Number two, there is absolutely no statute of limitations on murder. This is a capital murder case. 169 people, three unborns were brutally yanked out of world as we know it, life as we know it, within a snap of a finger. There are people that are going to be still held accountable, that people are still alive for either planning, committing, or covering up this case. You're all equally culpable in this. We want to see some indictments handed down and these people rendered justice. And number two, we want compensation of the victims, family members, and survivors. There is money that's due to these people, and we're going to see that happens.
But you also do you not also see that this ties in with other false flag events or events of, this catastrophic damage and loss of life?
Sure. Armin, you want to go ahead and comment on that?
The outrage of the false flag is that which compels the perseverance of discussing what really happened.
If you don't mind, folks, I'm sorry. I've got to step away for just a moment. I'll be right back. Give me about 5 minutes. I'll be back.
Okay, go ahead.
The inside job nature of this, the more you get into it, the more you see it, the more it just screams from the page. The people in a position to pull off a thing like this and avoid prosecution narrows the list of suspects dramatically. It's not the first time this sort of thing's happened it obviously wasn't the last. And after S-11, we don't know whether there's been enough activity in the truth movement on these issues and cases to prevent another one or not. It'd be great if it would never happen again. But as more and more people are made, the information is made available to more and more people, where more and more people get the question, now that pressure is off, it's in history, there's not any real direct bearing on this event, the publicity blitz is lifted. And the social compulsion to buy into what was said originally isn't anything as strong now as it was at the time. So people are starting to ask questions, well, what happened here, what happened there? The more people that understand what really happened, the more people there are to realize what kind of system and who is behind this sort of thing. And as the people in this country come to be fully satisfied to whatever level of detail they want, that this was choreographed in its entirety out of Washington, D.C.
Now, when you were dealing with this case, were you dealing more on the legal technicalities, or were you really getting into all the facts that were involved with this?
My exposure to this whole matter dealt with the legal side. There are some key facts in the matter, and it's still popularly accepted there was a truck bomb. So even in this group, I'm still a maverick. I'm the one saying, show me a truck bomb. I don't see it. There's no evidence of a truck. But that takes us into a side of the fact pattern in this thing that really didn't play in the Terre Haute litigation. What the Terre Haute litigation looked at was the fundamental legal principles. Do we have a limitation on where a criminal case can be tried? And the fundamental answer is no, we don't really have that limitation. It should never have left Oklahoma. It should never have been in a federal court. It's a homicide case. There's a lot of people who died. It's still a homicide case. And so the whole concept of limits on legislative power, limits on judicial power, limits on executive power that we have all been taught to exist, you see, have systematically and uncategorically kicked in the head here. So the main contribution I bring to this study is the legal side, and the legal side says we've really got to reevaluate what makes this system tick. When we go there, we're fine once we get through the weird and rather wicked paradigm shift, once we understand on the back end that the Constitution had nothing to do with this case. We start over again, and we ask ourselves, okay, what makes this system tick, and does it have a limit? And the answer is yes, it does have a limit. This is where we go in. This application from the Terre Haute litigation. The system calls itself correctly. It calls itself a federal system. And the notes that I send out from time to time to those that are interested in continuing to study into this sort of thing goes a lot like this. Federal means federal. It doesn't mean national. It most certainly doesn't mean constitutional. Federal means federal. At the level of a state, federal means by compact or by treaty. At the level of the individual, which not very many definitions, not very many dictionaries address yet, federal means by private obligation.
So you're saying this
right.
is this
right.
is So you're saying this has more of a commercial or...
Completely.
Okay.
A completely commercial thing. And of course, it's rather apparent, very self-apparently reinforced, even in the ruling in the Terre Haute litigation. The part that the court jumped all over me about with the term ludicrous has to do with the territorial and the special maritime and territorial jurisdiction provision in Title 18. Title 18, Section 7 is what they said was the jurisdictional provision in the trial courts for the case against McVeigh. Special maritime and territorial jurisdiction.
So how did he end up in Indiana then?
How did he end up where?
How did this end up in Indiana, having to go through?
Well, that's where they have the death chamber.
For
that's the execution facility.
For, I mean, that's got to be in a certain jurisdiction, because, I mean, don't they have more than one?
Well, see, we're into a different and supplemental angle on where are the limits. And ordinarily...
Go ahead. I think what she was asking, Herman, and correct me if I'm wrong, why he ended up in Indiana. And we got an answer to answer that. David Paul Hammer said that he was actually at the Florence, Colorado lockup where Terry Nichols is now, and McVeigh and Hammer were out there. They didn't have death row ready out in Terre Haute at the time. They took an old prison that was out there and renovated it and made it into the national death row, all of the federal prisons. So by virtue of that fact, that's why McVeigh was there. And when Harmon filed his litigation, he had to do so within that state and in that, what was it, the 10th Circuit or the 7th Circuit Court of Appeals?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, am I hearing, I mean, let me first say that I've got Chris Emery and Harmon Taylor, and we're talking about the Oklahoma City bombing here, but am I hearing a commercial aspect to the prison and court system, and it's between each other?
Well, they have to be.
Okay.
There's no other legal foundation on which the current system can at all justify itself. We can go to the money real quick and discuss that. If we had a legitimate system, and by that I mean a legitimate system of laws and structure by which to enforce them, the term dollar would be defined in terms of grains of fine silver. The law would recognize the honest system of weights and measures. And so silver would be, the dollar would be defined in terms of grains of fine silver, 370-some-odd grains of fine silver. The fact that dollar is no longer defined that way, and it's very circular, tells us that the fundamental choice of law changed. So where we have an honest system of weights and measures, then in matters that we would ordinarily think would be under the law of the land, would be under the law of the land. It's just intuitive to us. Where they unhinge dollar from a definition of legitimate weight, now it says a dollar is 100 cents. What's a cent? 1/100th of a dollar. It's very circular. There's no definition there. What happens is foundational change in choice of law. And
so,
that foundational change in choice of law takes us from the law of the land to the law of the sea instantly.
So you're saying that this sort of court system between different laws got involved in the process of McVeigh's trial?
Oh, yeah. That system had been gradually brought in. Of course, it changed in name in 1948. They went from District Courts of the United States to United States District Courts in 1948, gearing toward where they're headed now, which is a UN-organized and run system. UN is just another corporation. It's like General Motors. It just has people that pretend to be ambassadors. It's a joke. Sick joke, we're headed there. The thing is, where we have a system that doesn't recognize and does not circulate as the general medium of exchange, an honest system of weights and measures, that system has to be founded on the law of the sea. It's only in the law of the sea setting that a funny money system, the the paper basically worthless system can exist. If you try to run the paper money system that exists right now under the law of the land, the people issuing the money get into fraud real fast. And technically, it's actually an act of treason. We don't have to go to treason to understand that there's a problem. But it is literally an act of war, giving aid and comfort to the enemies, to run a funny money scam in a system that recognizes and uses an honest system of weights and measures. So to avoid that problem, the first thing that had to happen was changing out the law at its base. So they did that. Kennedy wasn't going along with it. They had to assassinate him to accomplish this. And it is the money system that's the overriding motive behind that assassination. The money system was changed out. Silver quarters, the last vestiges of an honest system of weights and measures, were sucked out of the system.
Okay, but so, but what I, when it comes to McVeigh, how does this end up being a, how do we tie it to an admiralty thing where they felt that they were, had the ability to take him totally out of an area that you would have figured would have been the one to try him?
Okay, well, once the silver gets sucked out of the system and funny money is in there in its stead, that's the best evidence of the foundational choice of law away from the legitimate system, the law of the land system, to the law of the sea system. Fundamentally, everything about Title 18 that applies anywhere looks to Section 7, Special Maritime and Territorial Jurisdiction, as its fundamental trigger for application. So everything about it's maritime.
So, Chris, when you, what type of aspects did you run into that may have tied in with what Harmon is talking about here? Or did we lose Chris? We might have. He's had having a birthday party.
Yeah, he's
so,
off on to that. He may still be there. The answer on that came out in the Seventh Circuit's opinion in the Terre Haute litigation. And that's where they got in and said that obviously the jurisdiction for the federal trial courts, Title 18, Section 7, and that's the eye-opener. That's the message. The system that is out there that we have been taught to see isn't the system that's really there.
Okay, now the Terre Haute came before or after the Denver?
Oh, well after.
Okay.
The first trials were there. We were doing appeals by, what, 96 maybe, 97? Almost for sure, the very first thing I did was an amicus brief in the Tenth Circuit. And amicus briefs on appeal, federal system, really aren't that much a part of the system. They were really diplomatic about it. They didn't unfile anything or send it all back, but they didn't really request any amicus briefs. There were, I'm remembering about half a dozen of us, various parts of the country, piping in on the same issue, which is you've got a major problem here of exporting a criminal case across the state lines. If Article 3 were relevant to the limitations on that judicial system, then what we saw happening couldn't happen.
Okay, now,
it couldn't happen. So Article 3 is obviously not the limitation. It doesn't create those courts, and it doesn't limit those courts.
Did I hear Chris come back?
Yes.
Okay. There he is. We're talking about maritime jurisdiction, and she was wondering what aspects on the factual side may have confirmed the maritime nature of the case, if there was anything that came to mind on that.
I'm not versed in that, Melody. I have to punt to Harmon. I just look at it from the scientific and the evidence point of view, and like I said, the chain of custody. Harmon is infinitely more well-versed on the court and the judicial side than I am, so I really don't, I'm not qualified to answer that.
Okay, so now the first aspects of this case took place in Oklahoma City, right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
and then they moved it to Denver.
Yes. And
it was supposed to go to Lawton, from what I understand, the federal court down there, and they, for some reason, decided to change the venue. There was, here again, I guess the media pumped that up and really threw a wrench in the works there.
Yeah, that's where we get the clear orchestration between the federal government and the media. They had to get that jury. They had to get a jury that had no experience with the bombing. The people in Oklahoma City and even throughout the county knew of multiple explosions that morning. They experienced multiple explosions. The government's theory is based on an external ground-based point source, a la a truck bomb, which, you know, as I mentioned earlier, there's no evidence of that, but that was their theory. So for that theory to fly, they had to get a jury completely unexperienced with what really happened. So there we have the motive for moving that case as far away from Oklahoma City as they could legitimately justify.
Now, Chris,
so there it goes out to Denver.
Chris, how many people did you interview for this film?
We have, at two record right now, including Harmon, 24, and there are several others that we were able to get bits and pieces of since I moved to Oklahoma City in January of 2003. The interviews, most of them were not on tape. A lot of them were dictated and by notes and so forth. Over 328 victims, family members, and survivors. A good majority of them gave us information that was able to help us corroborate what we already knew. A lot of them requested not to be on tape. We had to respect their privacy. But since January, we did the last of the follow-up interviews, and to date we have 23. We've got about four more, and then we're going to go into final edits and post-production, do a rough cut, distribute it to the folks that we've had on the film, and then we're going to do a final, what they call cut the negative copy, which will be headed to the distributor and out by January, middle to the end of January of next year.
Now, you had, I mean, I've run across this in numerous aspects, like 9/11. How much is enough evidence, and what was it that convinced you that this was, you were going to devote so much time to it?
It took me a good question, and I appreciate you asking that. And I think I've shared this with Harmon several times, so bear with me, Harmon, if you've heard this before. It was at the encouragement of Jerry, number one, to actually look at the tape. Number two, after about watching 45 minutes of the 2.5-hour tape, I realized that what I was told on the evening news and, you know, throughout the magazines and coffee table magazines and so forth about the case was complete garbage. I mean, it was completely upside down. And as a filmmaker, I said, well, you know, it's a responsibility to at least get the information out there and have the viewer decide for themselves. There are enough intelligent people out there. We want to complement their intelligence versus insulting it, like a lot of movies do today. And what convinced me to go ahead was I tried everything I could to find anything that would support the official story. And every single step of the way, it was a similar journey to Jesse Trinity, you start opening up doors that not only contradict the official story, but corroborate an alternative story. Now, granted, there were some that were out there that were really way out in left field, but I kept focused. I tried to stay online and on point with this. And 99.9% of the stuff I was finding out was supporting the findings of the Oklahoma City Bombing Investigation Committee. And that's a whole other facet. All of those folks are interviewed in the film. And again, as a filmmaker, it's like, wow. We're talking about the worst case of terrorism in the history of this country up till 9/11. Why in the world, right, is anybody going to be asked to believe a complete false, you know, set of information and set of facts that simply can't be corroborated by science, by law? And that's abhorrent. You just don't do something like that and expect to get away with it. And the bottom line is, number one, that, you know, you do want to remember the deaths of these people in a lie. Not only no, but hell no. And number two, what about the people that survived? What kind of legacy are they going to have? So, you know, at first it was rather daunting. I thought, okay, what's going to happen to me? I'm not naive. I'm not cavalier about this. There are consequences. But in the end, there was enough people that came on board, including Harmon, that convinced me that there are more reasons to do this and not to do it. And so that's why we are here. We are, what, 8 years later, Harmon. And I consider you one of my best friends. And I'm not just saying that because we're on the radio. You know that. We trust each other with our lives. We've gone through so much on this. I mean, the emotional highs and lows and just being slapped in the face in a figurative and literal sense so many times, being ridiculed about what we're doing, and we're still doing this because it's the right thing to do.
Yeah, once one gets the light bulb, once one understands what happened, then it's impossible to let it go. It's just compelling. So, yeah, we're gonna chase it until the bad guys get their upcomings.
Well, I had the opportunity to interview VZ Lawton with Chris, and there's a whole lot. There's plenty more people that it sounds like you're gonna be able to have in your film, and it's, mm-hmm. And the name of your film again is.
It's called A Noble Lie. A, and then the word noble, lie. And once again, that's a working title. That may change before the final release, but that's what we have now. The trailer can be found on the website, Free Mind Films. It'd be just Free Mind Films. Or if you go under YouTube, if you don't mind me plugging the trailer, to give people an understanding of the quality and the content of and the length and breadth that we want to get the interviews up to, and including Harmon's. You YouTube the title of the trailer is called A Noble Lie, and then simply after that, trailer, TRAILER, number one, and the sign number one, and it'll come up. It's a 3-minute, 39-second trailer, and it'll give you an idea of just a good taste of what the movie's going to be about. I think it's an excellent piece of work. It was premiered in New York City 2.5 weeks ago, the weekend of September 11th, coordinating with the commemoration of the September 11th tragedy. At a good venue, and the folks got a resounding ovation on the trailer. We're very happy to have it well received up there.
And your website is what, Harmon?
No website. I can give you an email address.
Okay.
LEGAL_REALITY, legal reality, @earthlink.net. Yeah, if I had any of my material out on a web page, it would be full-time occupation to fix it because it'd get hacked all the time. I, you know, don't have time for it. I send out emails, but don't try to maintain a website anymore.
Now, in the making of your film, I understand there's still ongoing events taking place around this bombing, correct? Like with
yes, absolutely. And Harmon, you can comment on Attorney Jesse Trinity out of Salt Lake City. He still has pending litigation.
Yeah, that's another one of the victims of the bombing. I don't know whether we count him in the total or not, but there was a fellow in this group of bank robbers that was brought in, or they thought they brought him. Anyway, there was a warrant out for him, and they brought this guy in that matched his description pretty much to a T. And it turned out not to be that bank robber. It turned out to be Kenny Trinity. Okay. Kenny Trinity was found dead in his cell. They called it a suicide, but he had bruises and marks all over his body. Chris can give you some more details about that. At any rate, it was self-evident when you know the details that he was murdered in his cell. And Jesse, the brother out in Salt Lake City, Utah, has been doing Freedom of Information Act requests for years and chasing down information related to his brother's homicide. The epilogue to that is that the fellow that they thought Kenny was found later. He was up for making an appearance in court, as I recall, And yep. The day before he was supposed to testify, he was found dead in his cell. Of course, they called that suicide.
We were supposed to do a tell-all interview, with, I believe, with a television station out of Louisville, Kentucky. And lo and behold, he suicided himself.
So oh, he did the interview. There was a different person that was dead before the court thing. Okay.
Yeah, there was. That was there was a key witness that was actually in the transfer facility. You're correct, Farman. That was a trustee and saw what happened in Kenny's cell. He was a couple cells down and across the hallway from Kenny's cell. Alden Gillis, I believe, was his name. He was due to testify in court.
Gillis.
Alden Gillis to tell the judge that he was asked by the emissaries of the federal government and the prosecution to lie and perjure himself on the stand for Jesse Trinidad. And he says, no, he had enough confidence and trust in attorney Trinidad, Kenny's older brother, to say, I'm not going to lie for anybody. I'm going to stand by this attorney because he's doing the right thing, and I'm going to tell you what I saw. Well, he's found hanging high, you know, before he's supposed to go into court. And then Richard Lee Guthrie, who was Kenny was mistaken for, was
there,
supposed
there
to go in.
Guthrie. Oh, he was the one that was going to be interviewed.
Exactly. So go ahead.
So, yeah, Guthrie was the named guy, and before his discussion on the matter, they found him dead. So just, it's the Kennedy thing sort of thing all over again. You got all these witnesses and extra people out there just dropping like flies.
So how many?
And not by their own hand.
Yeah.
How many do you think?
Homicided out.
How many do you think have been this happened to during for this particular event?
Well those three, Terry Yankee. Who else? There's some suspicious health problems by a few of the people.
Right. Michael Lautenschlager, who was actually a GSA employee, who forewarned the Oklahoma City Fire Department about 2 weeks before the bombing happened that there were explosives stored in the building, highly illegal. You can't even have a box of rifle bullets, let alone C4 and blasting caps, which were in a reinforced bunker room under the nursery. This is not a cinder block room. This was cinder block and 10-inch concrete walls, specifically poured to reinforce the cinder block, specifically for the purpose of putting unexploded ordnance in the storeroom. They should have been taken out to the Oklahoma County Bomb Squad gun range, about 10 miles outside of town, stored in the federal building. Huge, huge lapse of protocol and highly illegal. And Lautenschlager knew was there. There was a lease that was due to come up to renew the management for the nursery right above this building. And Lautenschlager told the manager, it just so happened April 1st, 2 weeks, 2.5 weeks before the bombing, the lease was re-signed under a new company, and the old manager was let go. They never had their lease renewed, and that stuff remained in the room below the nursery, and all basically it just compounded the multiple explosions in the building. And nobody was held accountable. Now, we have proof of that stuff in there because it was still unexploded C4 after the bombing. And it was being handed out by a Bunker Brigade line with the Oklahoma County Sheriff's Reserve officers. And that's what Terry Yankee witnessed. And he couldn't get it out in the report. He was asked to redact it from his report. So, Melody, I mean, it's just a compound. It's like peeling back an onion. It just got worse as you investigated this. It didn't get any better. It got worse.
Well, did you run across anything odd in the insurance situation, anything that tied into what, like, maybe a Silverstein type of setup?
No, this is completely opposite. The building, and Harmon can reiterate this, the building was actually owned by Oklahoma County. It wasn't that the deed was ever signed over to the federal government, so it was a county building, county property. But as far as any money... No, it was just a complete breakdown of communication, compartmentalized. They were trying to do a sting operation that went horrendously wrong. You got 169 innocents, three unborns, and then it's just a malfeasance of cover-up from a local, county, state, and federal level. The guys that chose to cover it up did not do it by choice. They were forced to do it. And then on the counterpart to that, there were good people within all of those levels that came out and said, we know what happened here. You know, our friends, our cousins, good people we know, relatives, close family members, immediate family members who were killed in the bombing, find out what the hell happened. And it's those people that have come forward over the years giving us information bit by bit. Carmen, you know, drip by drip, you can corroborate this, that still want the truth to come out. So as far as the payoff now, there was nothing on that order.
But it did have events or papers that were placed inside the building that might have covered up some things that had to do with
Barry. Go ahead, Armin, you want to comment on that?
Yeah, one of the more shocking things immediately after the bombing were the fact that there were victims that were possibly within time range of getting medical treatment to preserve their life. And the first people there in, we'll just call it suits and dark glasses, walked over these victims, the dead and the dying,
to
pick up papers. And one of the sets of papers that was stored in that building was the drug investigation, the drug trafficking investigation involving Clinton and people in his administration, because he was in the White House at the time. There were strings pulled, and obviously the investigation was stopped. All of that material was stored in the Murrah Building. And the clear motive from my point of view, and I'm sure I'm not alone in this, is the destruction of those documents. And it's just, it's very Clinton-esque. He really didn't care if anybody saw him do anything that he did. He just is well, he just, there's several psychological terms to use here. Fundamentally, he didn't care.
And he's a sociopath.
Yeah, we can go there. We can in a heartbeat. And the thing was, he is just talking bull, sure enough, about himself and the whole matter, as if to say, okay, so what if they know? What are they going to do about it? And we see this sort of bravado, in-your-face attitude permeate this entire matter. So we've got the drug records, drug trafficking records there by policemen in the federal government. We got DEA and other people involved in that, and they were doing their job. And their work was obviously destroyed. There were boxes pulled out of the rubble and taken over to a makeshift storage area in the post office. It wasn't much of a secure area, but it was something separate. And then not long after that got set up and things settled down, a white truck, panel truck, shows up. People get out in their black uniforms, submachine guns. I was remembering that it was early in the morning. I've since been reminded that it was probably in broad daylight, but at whatever time of day they did this, this group of masked, armed people went into the post office, took all the boxes out, loaded them in the truck, left. And to this day, not a word else has been said about drug trafficking in Arkansas and in that whole chain of events that led to the drug trafficking investigation in the first place. So it's super abundantly clear to me why the Murrah Building was targeted. We had information, it goes back, yeah, there are three buildings in the nation on the final list, and of course that's just distraction by somebody to shift the focus away from what really happened and why.
We have a key witness that is in custody now at State's Prison in Colorado, and I'm going to not name the name, but Armin, you're familiar with this individual.
Sure.
He was actually an informant for the U.S. Marshal's Office and the FBI in Denver at the time. And some of the credible, I have to qualify this, there are good people within the various law enforcement agencies, like
sure.
I said, that have come forward. So not everybody's bad. There are people that do show up for work and punch the clock with their sidearm and their gold badge that actually are trying to do the best they can. It's their superiors and the final decision makers, as we say, the guys that move the chess pieces around the board that corrupted this thing from the word go. But getting back to Denver, this particular informant was asked to by some of the perpetrators that actually made the ordnance devices and the timing devices to go with them that were in on the interior columns of the building. They asked this informant to smuggle in those timers, the electronic timers. This whole story about McVeigh lighting a long wax fuse and you know, stopping at a stoplight and wondering if he's going to blow up the truck—that's cartoonish. That's strictly, you know, that's right out of Warner Brothers. It's complete, you know what. What really happened is electronic timers that were used on the devices in the columns. But this particular informant was asked to ship those in across the border, and he said, "Look, I'll bring in your drugs and your weapons. I'm not going to be bringing any explosives, and I'll be damn sure I'm not going to be blowing up federal buildings." So he's working hand in hand with some of the perpetrators that were actually involved with this. And so much so that he was actually at the Hilton Hotel, just south of Denver Airport, about 2.5 weeks before the bombing. And he saw a full set of blueprints, working blueprints of the Murrah building laid out on a boardroom table in this suite at this hotel. So this isn't rumor. This isn't conjecture. This isn't internet gossip. This is fact. And this particular a witness is in custody on trumped-up charges on a long jail sentence in a state prison in Colorado. Once he gets out, and he's going to get out soon, that's going to blow the lid off that aspect of the case. So you see, Melody, we're not sitting on our thumbs just, you know, wondering what's going to happen. We have fact. We have documentation, reams of it. And this is solid stuff. And like I said, people are going to be held accountable.
Okay, well, let me go ahead and say you're listening to Truth Quest with Melody on KHEN. LPFM Radio, 106.9, Salida, Colorado. We're streamed on the internet at khen.org, and TruthQuest programs are archived at www.givemesometruth.info. And if you have any questions for the program, we've got an email address of khen.dj@gmail.com. And again, the program is archived at www.givemesometruth.info. And this evening I've got Chris Emery and Harmon Taylor, and we're discussing the Oklahoma City bombing and some aspects around it, and as well as Chris's new film that's fixing to come out on the Oklahoma City bombing, and that is, again, you've got kind of a name it that is...
called A Noble Lie, and the trailer for the movie can be found out on YouTube, A Noble Lie, space, trailer number one, just the sign number one, and it should pop up for you. It's 3-minute, 39-second trailer.
Okay, and I want to say the views expressed on this program are those of myself and or my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the KHEN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. But at the same time, Chris has been doing one whale of a job investigating the Oklahoma City bombing. And I heard you say, Harmon, earlier, you call it S-11?
S-11, yes.
And your reason for that?
To control the label, to control the name, is to control the story. So I don't call it the Oklahoma City bombing. I call it the Murrah building bombing. I don't call it 9/11. I call it S-11. The control exercised by the controlled media, even just through the labels, throws people off. So I don't use their labels.
And so do you find the tie-in between 9/11 and Oklahoma City or any other major events that... were used to terrorize the American public?
I do, yes. There's at least a three-step process in my mind, going back to the alleged truck bomb bombing of the Marine barracks in Beirut, to look at the Marine barracks building and to look at the Murrah building in its damaged form is to get a really shocking deja vu going. The damage is so identical. And, of course, we were told that the truck came across and went through the fence and went into the Marine barracks, and that's hogwash. There was a test of the bombing device used on the Marines in Beirut. Again, it's an inside job. It wasn't a terrorism thing at all. Well, it was terrorism, but it was inside. The bombs that took out that building were inside that building. What we have in the Murrah building bombing is building demolition from the inside. It's impossible. If there were a truck bomb, it's impossible for an ANFO device, even of the greatly enlarged size that Charlie Gibson and, what's her name? I'll think of it in a minute. The ABC Good Morning America crew did. Mm-hmm. They greatly enlarged the size of the ANFO bomb, and it's the largest size I'd ever heard about. But anyway, if the ANFO bomb were of even that size, it would have been impossible for the damage that we saw to that building to exist. The mere concept of a truck bomb was planted in the media mind within moments. There was a phone call that came in, oh, there's a truck bomb. So everybody's talked about that ever since, but even if that were the case, the maximum pressure that would have gotten over to the nearest next building, the General Records building across that parking lot, would have been about the same as a hairdryer on full blast. A hairdryer on full blast over that entire roof is not even going to make that roof yawn. It's not even going to know it's there. That roof was torn off. We can go into any number of details of the description of the device that actually detonated, but fundamentally, the part two here, we got the Marine Barracks test, and then we've got the Murrah Building, which actually was its own test. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, we've got the super high technology demolition demonstrated in S-11 bringing down the World Trade Center towers. And then all of the technology used to run those airplanes.
No.
To run that. So, yeah, in my own mind, I'd put all three of those together, stepping stones.
Now, one of the things that you were just talking about is the fact that there seems to be ongoing casualties that seem to be tied around this event. And while at the same time nobody's really being held accountable that should be held accountable, and that the people that are stepping forward are the ones that are paying the price. Is that a correct assumption on my part?
Those that step forward that actually have evidence of stuff are the ones who seem to be at risk of life and limb. Those of us out here on the sides that are doing the digging on stuff are just that. We're out on the side. It's not the kind of thing that the big boys behind this would be concerned about as being evidence. Yeah, there's evidence there, but it's in the nature of the investigation side rather than actual personal experience.
Well, wasn't Yakey somebody that was investigating? Why would he have been so likely to have possibly met his demise from nefarious ways?
Chris may be able to.
Yeah. Officer Yakey was, that morning he was issuing a traffic ticket about 4.5 blocks due west of where the Murrah Building stood, dropped his ticket book, and I had a chance to talk to the lady that actually he was issuing the ticket to that morning, and she said that he dropped the ticket book, got in his squad car, and sped up to the bomb site. And what he saw during the first 15, 20 minutes, saw the multiple ordnance damage, and that there were ATF members of the ATF and FBI that simply could not have been there as quick as they arrived if they had not been there or had prior knowledge of the event or anticipating the event. So that in and of itself was a huge anomaly for him to try to get out. Later on that evening, he tried to badge his way into the crime scene and was refused because word got around fast that Terry wasn't going to lie for anybody. He was a straight arrow, 7-year veteran of the police department, and by the book. I mean, he really did things thoroughly. And that was actually, that came to bear out in the next year and 3 weeks before he was brutally murdered, that he was asked to cut down a 13.5 page report by his commanding officer, Lieutenant John Randall, at least 3 times. And at the very end, they seemed to squeeze out a page and a half. It was complete watered down garbage. It was nothing even close to what Yakey wanted submitted. But to answer your question, we don't have any definitive proof who killed him, but we do have the proof that he was murdered, that he certainly didn't commit suicide, and in very, very suspect circumstances. To this day, even up to about 6 weeks ago, and I shared this with Harmon, but I'm not able to share it on the radio, that there are individuals at the police department that still are stomping down and putting an ironclad seal on this. They do not want to cooperate with the family, and they are fighting tooth and nail to get any information out on this. It's really sad. It's shocking. It's sad. And as we say before, and here again, Harmon has heard this, we're not so much surprised as we are disappointed. That you think that people would be man enough, men, and you know, and show their fortitude and their goodwill and their morality, the level of morality that they have on this, and they still choose to fight the facts in this case and cover them up to and including the police chief. And I have no problem saying that on the radio because he has a lot to be held accountable for, and I have no respect for the gentleman whatsoever.
He just won. There's a whole bunch of people who know stuff, who are in positions to have done right, and
right.
who have actively bent over backwards to facilitate the cover-up.
Now, do you find that there's a lot of correlation in personnel or people, commissions, that crossed over between this event and other ones?
Oh, absolutely. Harmon's familiar with the perps. What's really scary, Melody, is, for lack of a better analogy, and people might think we're being trite or cute about this, we're not. We are living a real-life example of the Twilight Zone here in Oklahoma City. And to a certain extent, the people in New York, too, are doing that. Just by, we know that we're being lied to. That's not even enough for debate anymore. That's a given. I mean, okay, so that's on the table. That's solid. We're being lied to. We know who's lying to us. We just want to know why in the world they continue to lie to us almost 16 years on. And for the people that are crossing over between Oklahoma City and 9/11, we've got Muhammad Atta showing up a good year and a half before 9/11 even happens, wanting to stay at the same hotel that at least 12 of the 18 perps who were involved with Oklahoma City stayed at from December of 94 through the morning of the bombing at April 19 of 1995. There's a den of thieves that came through Oklahoma City from September of 94 right up until 4 days before 9/11 occurred. And they're crossing paths with the same people at the University of Oklahoma, 20 miles south of Oklahoma City. They're staying at the same hotels. They're running out airtime, basically pilot time and cockpit time at the Airman Flight School in Norman. This is not coincidence. It can't be coincidence. There are way too many overlaps. And, Harmon, you want to comment on that?
We've got an interesting correlation on who investigates what and their relationship to the people that I'm pretty sure are the planners of it. We've got an interesting correlation of the cleanup crew. There was, and they may even be tied to Waco, the mm-hmm. people that did the destruction of evidence in S-11. It's the same contractor, I'm 98% certain, was this contractor.
Controlled Demolition, CDI. Yep.
Yeah, but weren't they also
weren't they in on Waco, too? I don't
I'm not sure about Waco. I know Waco was, oh gosh, we just there's that's a whole other show. Melody, information came to light about 3 weeks ago. We may be doing a movie on that.
Wow.
No, that's a whole other conversation. That was horrendous, absolutely horrendous.
No, but 9/11 had controlled demolition involved, right?
Right, CDI.
Right.
Yeah.
So, go ahead, where you were, wasn't it?
Well, just to give a sampling, and it is merely a sampling of the correlation in personnel and the correlation in concept between the Murrah Building bombing and S-11. One of the features now of some of the conventions that go over what happened with the S-11 events is the correlation, and Chris has been to several of them and has been speakers at several of them on confirming to those that show up to those conventions how many correlations there are between the Murrah Building bombing and what happened in New York City.
Looking at it just from the science point of view, Melody, you know, basically within minutes after the bombing happened, and then you get the Inspector General's report, and then you get Harmon getting kicked in the teeth resoundingly from the district court out of Chicago. And then you have what is called the FEMA report, which was the basically the BAPT, that was the advance team that came in to study what had happened here before the final verdict was handed down in federal court. This was supposed to be an independent group of scientists. Dr. Corley, who actually had a team of about 12, I believe up to 14 individuals, some of the best of the best structural engineers and forensic investigators in the country. But you go back and you find out whose payroll these people are on, and all the arrows point back to the White House administration and the Department of Defense. So you say, okay, well, you know what? At least we know who they work for, and at least we know why the answers are giving or coming out the way they are. That's not even a mystery anymore. Here again, it's, you know, that's fact. That's on paper. But the report itself, and this is very telling, Melody, this is really, as you say, we're not so much surprised as we're disappointed. The subterfuge and the obfuscation and the criminality, it is so pervasive. I mean, it's unbelievable. I mean, it's right there. It's screaming out from the pages. The very first, I believe it was with the prefix, prelude page number 4, it says, qualifications of these scientists, they couldn't get within 200 yards of the Murrah building. They literally were 2 football fields away. And that
doing
was
by the... This is the inspection crew. They're doing it by telescope.
Yeah, I mean, and furthermore, they couldn't see any shop drawings of the building. They couldn't even see the working blueprints. And they weren't giving 1 ounce of any evidence from the crime scene. They were giving core samples that were, quote-unquote, similar and attributed to the plans of the Murrah building, not even from the building itself. And they were asked to give an objective view of what had happened there and give their professional opinion on what could have been done to prevent the destruction of the Murrah building. And their conclusion was, well, it was under an earthquake fault and mitigation on how to avoid destruction of buildings in the earthquake, nothing to do with multiple point source blasts or ordnance inside the building. It was completely ludicrous. And this was a white paper that these guys offered with FEMA's name stamped on the front. And I thought, wow, just when you thought you couldn't get any worse. And then it did get worse with 9/11. These guys, the same crew, and then some of their colleagues or understudies, were asked to come back and do a similar report for 9/11 and for the Pentagon. Oh, and so you see what we're up against here, Melody.
Mm-hmm.
And people wonder why we're doing this film. Why not do the film? I mean, I get frustrated when I even think about the publications these guys have.
This may be a little off the wall, but it doesn't seem like anybody that is involved with these, because there is no statute of limitations on murder. So this is their chain, ball and chain to keep people from talking. And when I've done an interview with a professional assassin, here you have somebody that's trying to come clean going back, and he was asked to be involved in on the Kennedy assassination. And yet, because of that particular statute of limitations, he's not finishing up the very last bits of his, you know, the truth. And I'm just wondering, if we took this statute of limitations out, how many would come forward? Because they would lose their ability to control them with that.
Good point. But here again, you have the three stages. And Harmon, I think you alluded to this early on, right after we had met, that to really get a thorough view, and to answer your question, Melody, to get a thorough view of this case, you look at who was involved in the planning, who was involved in the commission, who was involved in the cover-up, and, you know, who stood to gain from any or all of those stages. And that's what we're going to try to wrap up in this film. And the viewer is going to make the decision. We're not going to be vindictive. We're not going to be sophomoric and say, well, we think this happened because of this. No, we're going to base it on fact, and we want the viewer to decide. And then there's going to be enough, we have enough information, and Armand, you've stated this before, that there's enough information now just by virtue of looking at this film and the people coming forward to get in front of a grand jury that has the fortitude and the intelligence to say, hey, you know what, and further indictments can be handed down. And I would suggest, I'm going to do this on the air, and I think I did this on a couple of interviews, one for a radio station out of Canada. The people that are responsible for this, that are going to be held accountable. There's two suggestions I'm going to throw out here. You get a competent legal counsel, and you get your personal affairs in order, because you're going to go to prison. That's not a threat. That's a promise. That's how solid and that's how competent we are on the information we have.
And it has to happen. We pursue this until we get the convictions. And they've controlled that prosecutorial mechanism very well all And we'll just see. We'll just see whether there's something in the way of what I call fullback up the middle that can happen here. Fullback up the middle is not the only response, but it's a response, and it really will be the culmination of our commitment to this, to see the rest of the people involved in this thing get tried and convicted on the evidence. And that means everyone who's had a hand in fabricating the case to date. And there are a lot of people involved.
Well,
a lot of people involved.
Now, one of the things that's kind of come out of this event and others is they like to use the lone gunman. And then there was something today that kind of took place down in Austin.
Oh, my God.
Did you hear about that?
Yeah, I saw that on Fox News this morning. I really watch Fox, and that just smacked of setup right there. It is. I mean, here again, pull out the clipboard, Harmon. Right, go down the.
Yeah, put up another one. It's amazing that he only shot himself. Somebody's mind training failed there because he didn't take any victims with him. Maybe his gun jammed or something. But yeah, for UT to have a Manchurian candidate thing go on. I kept looking for the date. What's significant about September 28th?
When did the first one? What was the date of the first one?
In Austin?
Hey,
mm-hmm.
What was that during the summer? I forgot. But the
okay.
Early 60s.
Well, I mean, there's been some of these dates have some numerological.
That's a very good question.
I'm going to have to check and see if that's the correlation of it. I haven't found anything yet, and I haven't chased that side of it. Yeah.
I called a colleague of mine on the way down to Fort Worth. He was on his way down to Fort Worth to take care of some business related to the film. And I said, "Did you see the piece on Fox this morning?" And he says, "No." And I explained it to him. And I said, "Mark my words, James." He's one of our co-producers. I says, "Number one, Alex Jones is going to rip this thing to shreds in about 2 days. He's got enough people down there, competent guys on the staff in the studio. They're going to get their nose in there and find out what happened. And number two, Fox is going to basically let this thing slide off the radar screen. Within 3 weeks, you're not going to hear another peep about it, because it's just going to dissolve right at their feet like ice.
Yeah,
on that day, it's not going to go anywhere.
Well, being that it's in Austin again, it almost makes me have to wonder if it's not designed for a distraction.
Well, sure. Almost all of these things are. We've got the real problem politically about domestic and foreign policy. And so the people need something else in the way of bread and circuses to keep them entertained while Rome burns, you know.
And also, is there some sort of gun legislation on the table at this point?
Right. Now, the Texas, you know, there's if you want to have an anticlimactic result, you don't pull something like that in Texas and expect to get gun legislation, because Texas is one, and Oklahoma are two of the states with some of the most steadfast Second Amendment laws in the books. You know, you go up on somebody's porch in Texas, you try to rob their house, and the owner of the house can come out and shoot you dead there, and they're not going to be indicted for murder. I mean, that is their right to do that. So why in the hell would somebody foolish enough to try to get gun rights legislation through a foolish stunt like this in Texas? That's why I think it's going to go off the radar screen in about 3 weeks. It's just, it is so bad. It is so transparent. It's sophomoric. It's really irresponsible.
There is that angle on the correlation with S-11 and the Murrah Building bombing. There was legislation almost immediately ready to go when the Murrah Building was bombed. It hadn't passed before. So after the bombing, legislation went screaming through the Congress. And then I forget how many pages it was that they passed after S-11, but it was impossible to get that 1,000-some-odd pages drafted in the time between the event and the time it was being introduced on the floor of the Congress. So
you can imagine our indignation toward Bill Clinton. I don't care if he's a former president. I have no respect for the guy as far as I can toss him. And to see him, his face, his mug on the TV now, knowing what he did just here in Oklahoma City, notwithstanding the fact that he helped pollute the streets of this country with literally tons, truckloads of drugs. I mean, just one thing after another. So we have no respect. And I don't know, I'm speaking for myself. I don't know if I speak for Harmon, but how can anybody have any respect for that guy? for what he did and what he continues to do, and then have this smug arrogance, like, you know, he's skating away from this. I mean, how would you feel, Melody, you know?
Well, I see a lot of buildings and streets and various things named after various scoundrels throughout history, and because of the memory of people, a lot of them don't have a real memory to tie to it because they have these false memories placed in their minds.
Yep, a lot of that. The publicity that the drug dealers who hold high office in federal government get is purely fabricated.
Here's another old angle on this, Melody. I don't know if you're aware of it. Harmon has helped me research the legality and the level of fraud. It is so pervasive even at the National Oklahoma City National Memorial Museum. The storyline in and of itself is garbage. But this past April, on every year for the anniversary, typically the week after, they have what is called the Legacy of Hope Award. They'll trot in some celebrity writer or somebody that may or may not be directly to the UN or some peace motive or foundation. Well, they bring in Bill Clinton, of all things, on the 15-year anniversary. Cut him a check for $5,000, handed to him, along with this gold-plated medal for Legacy of Hope, lauding him on the excellent job he did on the investigation. Oh, my gosh. You know, that's Harmon, what would you say? That would be the height of complete buffoonery, or you have to be an imbecile to do something like that.
Yeah,
and we're talking about people that you think are smart that are actually handing this stuff out.
Yeah, you got to wonder what side those people are playing on, because if Clinton and his staff did a good job on this investigation, then the people giving the reward are saying, yeah, you got by with it just fine, and we salute you for your butchery of innocent Americans in order to get rights declining and deprecating legislation through to promote the one world government agenda and wherever all that's headed. But yeah, it's just flat sickening to have the criminals in the matter rewarded.
Has anybody ever tracked the monies that were collected that were donated to these, you know, like 9/11 or Oklahoma City Murrah Building, and where it went and how it was spent? Has that ever come forward anywhere?
I know a little bit on the Oklahoma City case, Harmon, if I may interject here real quick.
Yeah, no, please go ahead.
By virtue of the grandmother to the kids that you and I know, well, she'll remain nameless at this point, she said the American Red Cross was supposed to send it to the people directed through the Postal Service, and it wasn't the fault of the postal employees. When a lot of those donations came in from around the world, they were funneled to the, they call the Center City Post Office, which is across the street from where the Murrah Building once stood. They've got a new one now, about half a block north of it. But a lot of those envelopes were put together in bushel baskets, the mail baskets, and given to, number one, to the governor's office, or number two, there were a couple of Baptist churches in town that rifled through every single one of those envelopes. And the checks were either endorsed by parties that were not authorized to endorse them and put into accounts that were not authorized to receive them, and the bank managers, everybody looked the other way, or the cash was taken and put into a fund which was run by the former governor's wife that was supposed to be put into a trust, an education trust. None of that money was ever seen again. The only trust for the education that I'm aware of that was ever manifested and legally distributed was through the Oklahoma City National Memorial. And that was done as strictly a PR stunt. And we still don't know if a lot of that money was administrated correctly, so there was a lot of gray area on this. But I do know for a fact that American Red Cross did not stand up properly and take charge of what had happened there. Now, as far as September 11, I don't know anything here, but I know it was completely upside down here in Oklahoma City, and that's fact.
Well, let me go ahead and say that I've got Chris Emery and Harmon Taylor, and we're talking about the Oklahoma City bombing and in the film that Chris has made on this event. And again, you want to go ahead and give the name of the film and your website again?
Yes, it's called A Noble Lie, and it can be found on YouTube on A Noble Lie Trailer Number 1 with the sign Number 1. and it's a 3-minute 39-second trailer on the movie. It's due to be released the middle to the end of January of 2011.
So you're saying that in light of all the events that you've been, aspects of this case, you're finding out more information on extraneous events besides. So are you really going to get, you said you were going to make a film possibly on one of them. So you see that this has just become kind of like your life's work then?
Well, yes and no. When you have information presented in front of your Melody, it's always a major decision whether you want to make a movie on it, because you have to, number one, get the personnel and the financial and physical resources to do it. We, by way of an individual that helped us with a lineup and interview for this movie, I got a call from them a few weeks ago about more evidence that has surfaced on the Waco tragedy, and that was a clear and premeditated effort by the United States Army and the Justice Department, up to and including Janet Reno's office, to not only murder these people, but systematically cover up and destroy the evidence showing that it was a wholesale murder. I can say without question that David Koresh had very little to do, if anything at all, with the Final Day murder. In fact, he didn't want that to happen to his followers. And luckily, through the grace of God, there were a handful of people that survived that, tried to get that information out in court, and some of them were acquitted of their federal charges of manslaughter and so forth against the, unfortunately, the three ATF agents that were murdered. But my experience as a filmmaker is you have to get a physical sense of what took place, and then you get a better understanding of how the details that you hear about on the mainstream media tie in. And then you see that 90% of them is completely false. What you see here on the radio or in television or and the magazines, these beat reporters or the high-end production manager, the station manager, simply don't go out there. They don't piece together the crime, and they end up embarrassing themselves horrendously. It's awful. But one experience I had with the Waco, and if I may just backtrack a minute on that, back in August of 05, I had a chance to go down to attend a gathering of Cindy Sheehan supporters about a mile and a half away from George Bush's retreat camp outside of Waco, his ranch. And on the way home back from Oklahoma City, I took a side hike to where Mount Carmel was, the site of the Waco tragedy, which is about 20 miles away. Getting outside of Waco and doing a just extrapolation of where Killeen, where Fort Hood is, where all of the personnel and the equipment, the helicopters, the armored vehicles, the Bradley vehicles, everything, were transported from Fort Hood, point A to point B, Mount Carmel. By the time I got from Waco to where Mount Carmel was, about 12 miles away, I was literally in tears, because your mind can just see that this was not by chance. These guys just didn't fly out there with a couple of helicopters to show up with a few Jeeps. There was a huge effort to get multi-million dollars worth of equipment out there, and one by one put these people through mental and physical torture, and then to torch them. And then any survivors coming out the back of that compound, they were shot systematically with automatic rifle fire. It was awful. I mean, it was a wholesale slaughter of these people. And then there were several charges dropped on the bus that was in the bunker behind the Mount Carmel compound. Children in there, 4 months old. And we have access to some of the autopsy photos. It was horrible. There was military ordnance used on these people. They had no chance. That is not what we live. You hear about that stuff happening in China and third world countries under dictatorships, not the United States of America. So, you know, if you hear the passion in my voice, it's like, we can't stand for these people. We cannot say, this is okay. Oh, we'll just let it fly. No, you can't do that. We're better than this. This is not as good as it gets. And we have to stand up for these people.
Well, literally, I've seen a group of people or more that have kind of came up from these kind of events and starting to pass information around and realizing that unless the people start speaking up and doing what you're doing, courageously doing is to get the information out so that when these events take place, they don't have the powers that be don't have the time to cover up and obfuscate all the evidence.
Herman, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, that's part of the plan, of course. They make all kinds of time to do exactly that. They see this from beginning to end, including the leaks to the media and to whom in the media to get that information so that it's a seamless presentation from beginning to end.
And so for us to stick our heads in the sand and think that this thing is just going to go away and it's not going to happen again, this is what's, you know, kind of coming forth, is that these are ongoing events, and unless we do start holding these people accountable, like the work you gentlemen are trying to do, we're going to continue to have this sort of violence and the taking of lives. Because it seems to be that they keep reinventing themselves, but so much that we're finding out that it has commonality.
Mm-hmm. One thing that I forgot to mention earlier, you'd asked me when we started working on this film what motivated us. I had worked for a small film production house in Fort Worth, and Harmon, you're familiar with where TCU is. It wasn't that far from the campus. For about 2 years there, and my boss knew of my interest in the Oklahoma City case after I left his studio and taken on some other work. At that time, I had done 5 small biographical documentaries, historical documentaries on figureheads in Dallas-Fort Worth and some accomplished Western artists and their work in a beautiful studio in Santa Fe. Anyway, this was my 6th project, by far our biggest budget, and little would I know, you know, so many years of research afterwards. But we met at a coffee shop in Fort Worth, and I was kind of mulling over the idea of really jumping feet first in this case. And he says, Chris, he says, you have to get bookend cases. I said, what are you talking about? And he says, you got to go, if there's anything that would support your work that's even remotely similar before and after Oklahoma City. And he says, if you can go ahead and research those 2 cases and find any validity to them to see whether or not the official story was true, then he says, then you have a good reason to pursue yours. And by God, if I didn't do that, it was World Trade Center 93. Even went back to the Ruby Ridge shooting. And as I was doing that, Melody and Harmon, I found out that there was a gradual escalation of not only the malfeasance and the, you know, the plan and the commission and the cover-up, but the body count. You go from Ruby Ridge, which was Randy Ruby's wife and his son, and then you go to World Trade Center 93, which was 6 people. Thousands were injured, minor and severely. And then you go to Oklahoma City, you have 169 plus 3 unborns. And then you fast forward to July of 1996, a week before the Atlanta Olympics, the shootdown of TWA Flight 800, which was an accidental shootdown by the U.S. Navy of that commercial flight, nonstop service from JFK to Charles de Gaulle, full plane, full crew, and then there were 18 employees of TWA flying deadhead with their families to go to Paris. And then you go ahead, and then you start looking at these African bombings, and then you get 9/11, which was close to 3,300 people. So, yes, there is a progression. And here again, you get your clipboard and your punch list out, and you go right down the line and you say, you know what, this is what's going to happen. This is what the media is going to do. This is what the federal government is going to do. And if there's anything resembling anything credible to go to litigation, this is what's going to happen. And by gosh, if it doesn't happen.
It's like they don't even waver, even though as bizarre as it would seem to tie some of these characters into some of these events, they
right.
still do it.
There was a quote to Harmon that you put out on the internet about 4 years ago, and I have this on my logs and some of my notes. You said, "How can you expect any decency from anybody that I don't know if you remember that quote or not. I'm trying to loosely paraphrase it.
How do you expect morality of an immoral system?"
Exactly, and then you elaborated on it. It was a beautiful quote. And it's so true. You know, whether or not these people are brainwashed when they go into the academy or the FBI, and I'm not saying everybody does, but here again, your top decision makers, who is held accountable for the final verdict, the final decisions, whether it be in the media or the law enforcement, to give us a story, and you know, whether it's true or not? who's held accountable for if it's completely false and there's still a criminal involvement with it? Those are the people you have to point your finger to, and those are the ones you need to get indicted.
Well, you know, it goes down to more than just that. I mean, when you look at a system that grooms people to be set up for being the victims or being the perpetrators, it's as though we need to start really looking at how our whole operation of our society plays into this, because it does. And
exactly.
And until we start examining how and why this takes place, and this is where even you find even in when I was watching a movie Long Kiss Goodnight, and totally, you know, this was done in 1996, and there was a scene in the film where they come in and describe the, you know, 9/11 bombing. Totally out of context, but it just, you know, my jaw dropped. Now, why? I mean, it's like we're being programmed to accept these events.
There were several movies that came out in that time period that blame Muslims for stuff, so that people are conditioned to accept that theory just because it's asserted, not because it's true, but because they've been indoctrinated to it. It is interesting to go back and watch the movies in that time period and see all of the very deliberate pre-programming of the response in America to these events. It's just, you can't get away from the Hollywood influence. It's there. It's part of the agenda.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, the media coverage is part of the agenda. They leave nothing out of this.
Right. And to see how the media, you know, in the first 24 hours covered it here in Oklahoma City, they did a great job. And then, I should say, within the first 4 or 5 hours, and then after the guys with big shoulders roll in on their Learjets, you could see it went from credible to clownish to cartoonish to completely, you know, and just ridiculous, the storyline. And it just, I mean, it went from bad to worse and just tapered off from there. So anybody that says, well, the media doesn't have any influence, oh, come on. You know, what planet are you living on? But
exactly.
So.
Now, did you find any correlations even in the Columbine? Anything at all?
Columbine shooting?
Mm-hmm.
The information that I've discerned from that is there were two groups of shooters. There were the two kids that were there, and then there were two others wearing masks.
Mm-hmm.
The group of people shot in the library were shot by the adult fake team. The girl that had been heard on the emergency phone channel had talked of something about prayer, and so they were shooting the people that said anything about being Christian, because those people had information that would very likely have exposed the fact there were two teams there that day. And then, of course, the kids didn't commit suicide. They were murdered out, and that was done by the adult team to accomplish the objective of terrorism. It could have been gun control, could have been legislation, could simply have been, let's terrorize the people by shooting the kids in the school. It's a form of extortion when you get down to it, but that's an overview of Columbine.
There were former employees of the county sheriff's department, I forgot what the name of the county is there, that came forward and said, the storyline on this thing, you get good people in law enforcement, and we see that happening here, Melody, in Oklahoma City, and Harmon can attest to this, they know how things like this play out. And they're not going to be made as fools. They're not going to be asked to lie for anybody. And it's those folks that are coming forward, and they corroborated exactly what Harmon was saying. That, yeah, there were adults that went in there and started this thing and finished it off and killed the alleged perps. So, I mean, you know, dead men don't talk. It doesn't get any worse than this.
Well, how about it? Like with the Jones Massacre in Guyana, I think I'm saying that right. I mean, there's another one. Are we starting to see a trend? I mean, a correlation. They love the lone gunman aspect, but then there's also, it's like a mind control experiment in some of these events.
Whether the good CIA and the bad CIA, right, Harmon?
Absolutely.
Got the rogue CIA, and then you've got the folks that are actually there to try to do a good job.
Yep. We find that everywhere. I mean, there's real people on the law enforcement side in all of these agencies. It's just they're not the ones in the high levels of policy making and decision making. And so the real policemen and the real investigators in those groups don't ever really get to participate in these cases because they can't get the moral law enforcement people involved, or the case blows up. The political agenda is thwarted when the law takes precedence over the perpetrators. So, yeah, there's any number of people. My figure is at least 10,000 to one. I figure there's at least 10,000 good people in these places to everyone that's a crook. Now, that may be optimistic in my mind, but my point is we've got them greatly outnumbered. It then just becomes a matter of finding something that motivates the people in a position to do something to do it.
Right.
One of the things that seemed to play into this is that the consolidation of the media. I mean, so because when you have so many of these events taking place, they, in order for them to control it, they need to have as few news agencies out there covering these events.
Yeah, covering up these events, you mean?
Yeah, yes. I mean, there's so many aspects to start looking at, and this is where the people, you know, thinking that maybe, you know, somebody else needs to handle this or look at these things, but until we start asking these questions and talking about them and keeping it out there in the forefront, we're not going to keep the memory around, because our, you know, look how many years have gone by. There's generations now that have come and gone, going back to the Kennedy assassination, where there's people still trying to tie that into certain events of today.
Sure. Yeah, we know we were lied to about that one, too. Robert Kennedy assassination, we were lied to. Martin Luther King assassination, we were lied to. Secretary Brown assassination is another of the list of bodies under the Clinton body count. He had a big hole in his head. He didn't die from any plane crash. He was shot in the head.
Yeah.
Vince Foster, how many of these incidents can we go through and not see what's happening?
And yet,
I think hopefully what we will accomplish with the film is that when people see something even as in the scope of things as minor as what happened today in Austin, you immediately start throwing up red flags, not to be paranoid or be pigeonholed into a the disparaging remark of a conspiracy theorist, but generations now need to ask questions.
Yeah, I mean,
if they don't, you're going to get snowed under.
Get into the realistic point of view. There's just too much evidence.
Right.
There's just too many questions to be asked about a thing like that to let it go. And I don't know if we'll ever get to one of these shooters in time to get to them before they do themselves in and deprogram them and find out where their instructions come from.
There's
so many school shootings that we never had school shootings until we had the anti-gun agenda. And just think about it.
Right.
They go hand in hand. And so there's an agenda there. There's just an agenda there.
Right. And it can come down to very local levels, whether it is in, you know, small ways or larger ways. Now, Chris, in doing your movie, have you uncovered a number of things you didn't know?
That's in a way that's a loaded question. When I first started researching this, I was very blessed to meet individuals such as Harmon, and like I said, we've become good friends. I didn't know about the litigation side and the stay of execution efforts. When I saw John Ashcroft and George Bush step up to the podium and announce the reason for the stay, at the time, I just had more other things on my plate, dealing with the research of this film and tying up my loose ends with the research on the TWA case. But, okay, so you have the legal side. Then you have what really opened my eyes was to sit down at a kitchen table or a dining room table or a coffee table with the victims' family members and survivors and look either the parents, the siblings, or the grandparents straight in the eye. And some of them would open their hearts up. I mean, I would know these people for 5-10 minutes, maybe not even that long, and they would start crying because they knew that I wasn't there to pass judgment on them. They needed somebody to vent, to open their soul, and to at least tell their side of the story and what they thought had happened, whether or not it was true. But to have an unconditional audience to listen to them, and I found out that what they were telling me was true. And I know of a handful, especially grandfather. He had suffered multiple health issues when I was talking to him. He went to his grave knowing full well that he was being lied to about the death of his granddaughter and the bombing. And substance abuse problems, broken up marriages, dads leaving the families and never to be seen again, just moving out of the state. The damage just on the psyche of the survivors and the victims' family members was horrible. And to see that whole side of this case, which really at the time I thought had very little to do with making a film, well, I found out it's a very significant part because you're dealing with human nature here. You're dealing with the impact of what happened to human beings. And then to have some of the, you know, there's just so many facets on this thing that I never thought it would even open up or had any idea that it even existed. So I hope that makes sense. But mm-hmm. It adds to the genuine and the authenticity of this film because we know from various angles what happened to these people. And it's something the media either didn't bother to cover or they simply didn't have the resources to, and they were on to the next sensational story 2-3 months later. So... yeah, to answer your question, there were so many things that I didn't know about that I eventually learned.
How about you, Harmon?
There was a while in there where there's nothing but new learning. I can look at the building and say, just from basic common sense, scientific physics point of view, it's impossible for an external device to have caused that damage because the building is blown out. But then we check into the reports of the people that were there. We look at Pat Shannon's work, for example, and we've mm-hmm. got live testimony.
He's done some excellent work.
Just superb. He's one of the real early ones in on it. Live testimony. Witnesses that were there, yeah, we heard multiple explosions. We hear the tape recording of... from the Water Resources Building, they had that hearing going on. And we hear the multiple explosions in that, and it just leads one thing to another. One of the more interesting tidbits was the pouring concrete into the basement of the parking area that night.
That night?
Yeah, cement trucks lined up down the street to pour concrete into the building. Of course, this takes us down a whole nother area of the kind of device that was used and what sort of evidence or residue from that kind of device is left and how does one cover up that kind of information, that kind of data. Well, concrete's a real good way to do it. So there were structural issues. We can't get around the fact that it's probably a practical idea for structural reasons. But we're talking about active physical alteration of a crime scene. And with the amount of concrete that was needed, you don't have that on standby. There's someone had to have known ahead of time that much concrete was going to be needed. Right. And we just put all these things together and we find out who was where and we see how the media covers this part and that part of the matter and then it just one thing leads to another on learning all the way through it. But yeah, fundamentally, the ultimate lesson for me, of course, came through the Terre Haute litigation, and that hasn't stopped. Once we get out of our mind the lies we've been told to about the kind of system that we have, and we rethink that from the top of the mountain, we just literally start all over again, scrub the slate completely clean and start over again. What can we prove? Totally different understanding, totally different perspective of this system emerges. And then we start over again, and we apply those theories. And we watch them work in the judicial system. And we see what a wicked paradigm shift it is for the people who have to make these decisions. You talk sense about what really is happening in terms of the law, and the jurists just pull their hair out, scream, holler, fuss, fume, get very nasty with the litigants arguing what the law really is, compelling the jurists to hold to the oath they took, and they don't want to do it. They'd rather go with the lie than with the reality. So the point is, it's an ongoing process. Even to this very day, the paradigm shift on the legal side is being applied, and successfully. We see it happen successfully, very quietly, but very successfully. So, yeah, the learning continues, and of course the key thing for me was the Terre Haute litigation.
I just wanted to, was there any health after effects like you saw with the 9/11 event?
I think more on a mental side, Melody. In my experience of seeing the counseling, there's still people today that are going through. It kind of turned that question around. Back right before the 15-year anniversary this last April, V.Z. Lawton and myself had a chance to sit in a meeting of some of the victims, family members, and survivors, folks that are still drinking the Kool-Aid, as they say. They don't want to believe any alternative to the official story. We met a psychologist in this meeting, and of all places at the boardroom table of the Memorial Institute for the Prevention of Terrorism, which is pretty much a high-dollar arm of the Homeland Security, just to perpetuate, the evil terror, 9/11 terror type of threat, even in Oklahoma City. And they had the audacity to have it set up, within 100 yards or so of Ground Zero, where these people were murdered in Oklahoma City. But the point of that meeting was that I called out a lot of the patently false aspects of the official story to the psychologist, and you could see her blood pressure raise. And I was calling her bluff on a lot of this stuff. The things that she tried to counsel people on over the years, on the mental side of this and the traumatic side, based on her knowledge of the official story and the fact that she thought it was true, she literally got up from the table and walked out. And I'm thinking, wow, now there's a twist of irony. I'm calling the psychologist out on this, who's supposed to counsel people to alleviate their fears and anxiety about the case, and she doesn't have the information straight. And she was furious that I wasn't getting worked up. VZ was sitting next to me, and we're just asking relevant questions as he walks out of the meeting. So on that side, to answer your question, there's the mental and the physical and then the paradigm of understanding the shift, the cognitive dissonance. That's, I think, one of the biggest obstacles these people need to walk through. They've got to go through that wormhole, so to speak. They have to walk through that door, or else they're not fully going to understand what happened in the mirror. They never will.
Well, I want to thank you two gentlemen for staying up late and informing my audience again a little bit further on the events around the Oklahoma City Murrah building bombing and in making a film about it and following up with other aspects that you've, Harmon, like with you, Harmon, on tying into the legal aspects that have arisen from these type of events, and that I want to, if you have any closing comments, I'd like to, again, thank you for coming on my program. Harmon?
Go ahead.
It's been a great program, and of course, we will be available essentially 24/7 to those that want to learn more about the Murrah Building bombing. It's an ongoing effort, and the film, of course, will be a huge, huge boost to the effort of getting out what really happened. So it's just going to be great to watch that whole thing come to life and come to fruition.
And thank you. I reiterate Armin's comments. Thank you for giving us the opportunity to share our information with you. If you hear the passion in our voice, folks, it's because we know that we're doing the right thing. We're fighting the good fight, and we are going to hold the people that have yet to be brought to justice. We're going to hold them accountable for this. And that's the, I think, the true American way. You don't let people get away with things like this. If you have the resources and the folks like Harmon on board with you, you're definitely going to win the good fight.
And if we don't, you know, stand up like you two gentlemen, then these events keep having a way of happening again. And do we want to pass this along to our children and their children? And because that's what's been happening during my lifetime. And again, I want to thank you, and I hope, you know, I wish your film does quite well and gets out there and enlightens the public.
We'd love to have the opportunity to be back on your show once we get ready for the release of that. Melody, thank you again for the invite. Appreciate it.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Good night.
Night.
Good night.